Clean power is cheap, but sometimes it's cheap in the same way a $30 flight is cheap. It sounds like a great price, but the timing is awful. It leaves at 3 in the morning, and it includes a 9-hour stopover. Solar works a little bit like that. It floods the system with power in the middle of the day, and prices crash. But then the sun sets, and demand rises as people get home from work. And prices spike as a result. Today's guest is Terry Embury, Vice President and Head of Trading and Market Operations at AES Clean Energy. His job is all about the timing problem. He helps turn renewable power into contracts that actually work, hour by hour. For a while, clean energy deals looked easy. Power was cheap, prices were predictable. But now, if power prices are lowest when the sun is shining, what incentivizes solar? If battery profits get hit as more projects show up, why bother building more? With data centers growing faster than grids, what happens next? If the market doesn't reward your project, you look elsewhere. Quietly, long-term power purchase agreements, especially with big tech companies, are becoming the backbone of the new clean energy economy. Ultimately, it's predictable revenues, and not just cheap power, that decides what gets financed. But before we start, I have something to ask you. We want to give transmission a bit of a glow up. And we want you to tell us what's working and what isn't. So we will put the link to a survey in the show notes. If you could take 3 minutes to fill it out, we would be very thankful. Thank you. I'm Alejandro Diego, and welcome back to Transmission. Thank you very much, Terry, for joining us today. Could you start by introducing yourself, what your role is within the energy industry and AES, and what AES actually does?
Sure. So Terry Embury and I work for AES here in the Houston office. I am the Vice President of Trading and Market Operations. I believe I've got 14 traders, 15 people in market ops, and then we've got a couple of other groups. AES, the company, is a big developer. Our main customer base is the data centers, the big tech, hyperscalers, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Meta. That's one part of the company, a very large part. Once the deals are done and the deal is real, we're going to actually build something for a hyperscaler. My group would then manage the project once it's, we manage the risk in the deal from inception when we say it's real. So it's going to take X amount of time for it to start building and then, go all the way up to now we're making power with it. But there's also, risk out there. It could be basis risk. It could be, some length that the off-taker, the PPA buyer didn't take. It could be a multitude of other things that we manage, but we're managing all those things all the way from when you sign the deal all the way through when it's operating and to the end of the contract.
Okay, great. Thank you for sharing that. Just in simple terms for everyone to understand it in the audience, when a data center customer approaches you, they basically hire you to design and build the plant and later to operate and maintain them. Is that correct?
Yeah, so they're generally the, they want us to own and operate. They take the physical power. They want the renewable attributes as well, in most cases. Sometimes they want all of the attributes of the plant. Sometimes they don't. The pieces that they don't, we'll manage. The pieces that they do, we'll give to them.
Okay, great. And is all of your development on-site generation behind the meter, or is it also sometimes front of the meter?
Almost all of ours is utility scale, front of the meter. We've got the largest battery, for example, in California, that's operating in the U.S., 500 megawatt Bellfield. It's associated with a 500 megawatt solar plant as well.
I will touch up on that battery plant a little bit later on the episode for sure. In which regions do you operate in the U.S. and if so, globally as well?
So I only manage the U.S. So that's really all I can dig deep into. I know that we are in South America and we are in Europe, but I don't know the specifics. In the U.S., we are in every market except for CERT, the Southeast USA. So from like South Carolina down all the way to Florida, and then over to roughly Louisiana, Alabama area. That's the one area we're not in yet. Okay. But we are actually looking at projects right now.
Okay, great. Now jumping to your trading sites. Mm-hmm. You have traded across the whole arc. You have a lot of experience in the trading world and the energy industry. What's one specific recent market moment that captures how different clean, heavy grids with high renewable penetration feel compared to even 5 or 10 years ago?
When I read this question earlier, I was thinking what stood out to me. And everybody's been following the whole duck curve in California. Everybody saw that developing and you go, oh, that's interesting. And that was really caused by a regulatory laws that came into effect that said, you will build all this solar. If you're going to build new construction, you have to have solar panels. So there was a massive overbuild of solar in California that everybody else was watching going, well, that's interesting. And it's causing this low prices during the middle of the day, sometimes negative. And when solar started to move into ERCOT, in my mind, I was like, ERCOT is an open market. It's not being forced to build this stuff. There's no way that it gets to that type of duck curve very quickly. Mm-hmm. If it happens, it's going to maybe be a flattening. But it's going to take a while because it's an open market and you have so many other market forces happening rather than just a regulatory push. But it happens so fast in ERCOT. We in roughly 3 years, we went from a normal non-duck curve kind of a hourly price shape to now all of a sudden we have a very California-like duck curve. And I never would have, I would have bet against that. I would have taken the over by several years, for mm-hmm. sure.
From a trader's perspective, when these moments are coming or big changes are happening in the market, how do you think about the opportunities that arise and about the different technologies to make use of those opportunities? And how do you assess the timelines, the timing to capture those opportunities?
Yeah, based on what I just said, I would have been making the wrong trades if those were available at the time. That event happening created markets that we saw coming that weren't there before. Usually you trade a 6x16 product or a 5x16, depending on the market.
Can you explain what that means for our audience?
Sure. That's a 5 days a week, 16 hours a day, and depending on which market you're in, could be 7 to 22, I mean 7 in the morning to 22 at night or 10 o'clock.
Yes.
Or 8 to 23 if you're on the East Coast. But, and again, a 5x16, 5 days a week, or 6x16 in California, and then the weekends. And then the nights, the 1x8s. So usually those are the blocks that are regularly traded. But now a solar block and a non-solar block has also developed in the market. So you can actually trade that duck curve shape against the non-duck curve when the solar is not there.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. You have a big portfolio in CAISO in California. Where does the value of that battery portfolio actually come from in CAISO? And how does it compare to the value coming in ERCOT?
Let me answer the first part. Yes. The value is in California, I would say it comes from, in general, three different buckets, whether it be capacity, energy, and ancillaries. Capacity in California is called resource adequacy, or RA. So that's usually a pretty big bucket of value for the battery. In California, they're all four-hour batteries versus ERCOT, which is only 1 to 1.5 hour batteries for the most of them. I think people are just starting to look at longer duration, 2, maybe 4 hours. But that is, to my knowledge, that has not happened yet. So again, 4 hour batteries, RA and CAISO is a good bit of the value, roughly call it $9 to $10 a kW a month. The energy, you're really looking to capture the top four versus the bottom 4 hours. So the bottom four, the highest price 4 hours is where you want to discharge.
Yeah.
You want to charge during the very lowest 4 hours. And so that's kind of the minimum level of energy capture you're looking to capture with the battery. So then you've got the capacity, you've got the energy capturing the TB4, and then ancillaries is like a kind of a bonus bucket, so to speak. Generally speaking, you've got roughly 50 cents to a dollar per kW month-ish in ancillaries. The more batteries that pile into this market, the more those markets get crushed. Not only the TB4 getting flatter, so it used to be very peaky, now it's getting flatter. And the ancillary markets, when batteries first came in, we were looking at, call it, $3 to $7 a kW month. Now you're looking closer to 50 cents to a buck.
And compared to ERCOT, in that sense?
ERCOT, you're looking at a 1 to 1.5 hour battery, the majority of them. And the first movers were all the very small scale, less than 10 megawatts. So the interconnection process for small batteries is dramatically faster than utility scale, a 100 to 500 meg battery. So you could get them in faster, you could prove the concept. You're not going to disrupt the market dramatically with a 10-hour battery. Even if you're using it, for example, to offset congestion, you're really not going to stop the market or stop this arm. You're just going to capture the value with a small-scale battery.
And from a trader's perspective, which one of the two markets is more interesting? Or do you have more room to have a higher upside scenario?
A higher upside.
And with limited risk while hedging at the same time.
I would say the CAISO, only because 90, I'm not aware of any that are just merchant batteries. So in general, you have the entire thing, or at least 60-70% of the value of the battery is captured in a PPA. You're going to sell it to a hyperscaler. You're going to sell them the energy. You're going to sell them the RECs, especially when the battery is connected to a solar. So they get the energy, the RECs, the ancillaries. And then maybe we carve out the capacity and we'll sell that separately to another load serving entity. But most of the time when you go to the bank, it's just a much cheaper use of capital to say, I've got this entire thing locked up, versus in ERCOT where the majority of them are just merchant. So it's all your own capital and you're taking all the risk. Now the first movers in ERCOT made a lot of money. They essentially, in my view, they were proving the concept. And then once batteries started piling in and those first ones, the companies are now getting flipped, they're realizing that arb is going away.
And now with the fast pace in changing revenue conditions, as you mentioned, erosion of ancillary service revenues, compression of TB spreads, how are you adapting to these new trading market conditions? How can you maintain a competitive advantage and keep those revenues up?
I think that's the key then is the offtake agreement. Even if the spreads get compressed to flat, as long as the offtake agreement is such that they're taking the value or they're willing to pay for the value of that, then you can take that to the bank and get it financed. Generally, the market will, it's like a bubble. You press on a balloon and something pops out somewhere. So one piece may get squished, but then something else pops out. So energy may get squished, but RECs may get more valuable, or capacity may get more valuable.
Yeah.
In ERCOT, you've only got energy. You don't really have the capacity market that's going to pop. So you're really counting on volatility and price spikes.
Great. Thank you for sharing that perspective. You mentioned offtake agreements. Mm-hmm. Could you please explain on a high level what that means for our audience to understand it? And there are a lot of different offtake agreements. From your perspective, which ones or which one are or is the most interesting offtake agreement with current market conditions?
On the West Coast, we have, we sell a 7x16 product. So we'll pair a battery with a solar and sell a 7x16 relatively flat block to a data center. Yeah. They have a very flat load. They're the same all the time. So they're looking for a flat energy block. So we can create that with the solar and the battery, and we can, they need the power for a long time, and they need to guarantee it's there. And we need an offtake agreement for 15 to 20 years for the financing. So it's a win-win situation there. In PJM, batteries don't work, not yet. The batteries that were initially deployed in PJM were all small frequency type reacting to frequency, and those are essentially worn out at this point. Mm-hmm. But the spreads just aren't there to make sense, and the capacity market doesn't pay for batteries. So in PJM on the East Coast, we have the 24/7, the Google agreements, the Microsoft load following agreement, where we pair wind and solar and match it as best we can to try to create a relatively flat profile against a flat profile data center load.
We'll jump into the 24/7 project now in the upcoming questions. But before that, you mentioned that you're operating the largest battery in CAISO as of today. Can you tell us a bit more about that battery, what makes it so special, and where it sits?
It's called the Bellfield facility. It's almost all of our solar projects are in the high desert area. So if you look at LA, to just to the east of the mountains, there's the high desert area starting in roughly...
I would help you, but I have no idea about
it. If you've never been there, you're not missing anything. But there's a racetrack there. It's called Willow Springs.
Okay.
And that's the very southern part, all the way up to Bakersfield in this high desert plains. That's where almost all of our solar and batteries are. And Bellfield is roughly halfway up between that area and Bakersfield area. It's a 500 meg battery. It is a Tesla battery. It's paired with 500 megs of solar. And it just recently hit COD.
And what is the duration of the battery?
It's a 4-hour battery.
4-hour battery. Okay. Could you tell us, because I find this very interesting, one of your big bets throughout your career as a trader, and in what situation it was, what opportunity you saw, and what it led to?
If you'd have been in the market 10 years before Uri happened, you'd have seen Uri coming and knew what was going to happen. And that's when I was a very active ERCOT trader. And we saw this cold front coming, and it was, generally speaking, I was always a contrarian ERCOT trader. I was always short, always.
Yeah.
And if I saw where the market was getting close to the edge, I would just, it was too risky to go long because then it was kind of priced in. So I would either go flat, or when the market reacted to create a much higher price, then I would sell at the higher price. But when this event was coming, I saw it and I was like, this looks nasty. It's going to happen right away in the morning when load starts coming up. It's, the pipes are going to freeze where the gas is not going to be there. And so I went long roughly 500 megawatts from hour ending 7 to hour ending 12. And at that time, the cap in ERCOT was $9,000. It was $3,000. We're printing the cap from hour ending 6 until hour ending 12 or 13. So, and I will tell you, it made my stomach churn as badly as if I'd been on the other side.
Yeah.
It was a big day though. It was $7 million or something at that time.
Yeah, no, that's, thank you for sharing that moment.
What was the second part of the question?
So the second part was actually the most interesting project that you have worked on in the past, or one of them.
Since I made the shift from traditional energy or traditional energy companies, so I was at TXU, Arizona Public Service. I was at Direct Energy for 12 years. Over to AES, we've got some really interesting projects with the 7x16 products in CAISO. Managing that is always interesting. The load side, so if you've ever been on a trading floor that manages retail load is all over the place, but the generation is relatively flat. In these cases, the load is very flat and the generation can be all over the place. So it makes for an interesting dynamic. You're constantly in the market, either buying or selling, specifically around the PJM wind projects, for example. You've got the wind on average is expected to be 100 megs.
Yes.
But on a given day, it could be zero or it could be 200. And you're constantly having to say, what's it going to be tomorrow? What's going to be next hour? And how do I fill that need or sell that need in the market? So it's you're constantly moving all the time with renewable projects.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
Jumping back to something that you mentioned before, some 24/7 clean energy projects, and this is a service that AES also offers. You offer this package to big corporates, such as, for example, Google. Yeah. What has to happen on the trading and scheduling sites to make that promise real? How does complexity increase or decrease?
One of the things you have to realize is there's a limit to how much you can say recovering with renewables. And it all depends on price. So at a certain price, we can layer in solar and wind to use a solar profile, you know, during the day, roughly hour ending 8 to 16-ish. That creates a relatively flat block. And then you use wind to overlay that against a flat block data center load. Now you have to upscale them so that you've got constant coverage, but then you're also going to have gaps when the wind's not blowing, when the solar's not there, so that you have to scale them higher. So if you have 100 meg data center load, maybe you need 200 megs of wind to get an average of 100 megs. And maybe you need 150 megs of solar. But that still only guarantees you, call it 75 to 80% coverage.
Yeah.
And as you move up the scale to say, I want 90%, what does it take to get there? Well, now you have to layer in more solar, more wind, which is going to push the price up because now you're going to have a bunch of excess energy, or you're going to scale in batteries where they're uneconomic in PJM, and that's going to have to be priced into the load deal. So as you get closer and closer to this 100%, it gets much more and more expensive and harder to do. Unless, and I'll skip a little bit forward, you cover it with, if you want to go completely green, maybe you cover it with a nukes. Nukes, though, there's no new ones being built yet. That's, you can talk about that a little bit later, but in my mind, that's 10 plus years minimum. I would take the over on that for sure. But that's almost the perfect data center solution, right? 24/7 flat generation against 24/7 flat load.
How do you, in as a project like the one of Google, do you choose to build a battery rather than going to the market or signing an offtake agreement with another generator that can provide green energy, for example?
That's really a conversation in the deal process with Google, with Microsoft, whoever's on the other side.
Yes.
They have to say how much they want, and we can say, okay, we can cover that amount at this price with this amount of solar, this amount of wind. If you want it higher and we include a battery, it pushes the price from, I don't know, call it $50 to $65. And at some point they'll have to get price sensitive. Does that make sense economically? And it's just a conversation at that point.
Can you give us any figure of how much premium those type of clients will be paying for this type of product compared to going to the grid?
If you're just leaning completely on the grid, yeah, if you look at 24/7 grid power for, you know, call it Cal 26 coming up, you're probably paying $10-$15 higher.
Okay.
That also, though, gets you the REC value as well, which is not included in that 24/7 energy. So you'd have to add that in. And once you add that in, maybe you're only closer to a $5 premium.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So you're getting energy and RECs, and you're getting the coverage and the management of all that together.
Yeah.
So we're saying premium, but there's you're managing all that too. So it's not, that's not free either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, understood. You opened the door before, which is nuclear energy.
Okay.
What is your view on nuclear energy here in the US for the next 5 to 10 years? Will there be a comeback? Why not?
I'm a big fan of nukes. I come from the nuclear world.
Okay.
I was a reactor operator on a submarine in the Navy for 9 years. I got out and worked at a commercial nuclear power plant, Palo Verde in Arizona. It was my world for 15 years of my working career. I like nukes. They're very dependable. I understand it. Some people are scared of the nuclear fuel and what you do with that. How do you dispose of it? I completely get all that. The last nuclear plant, I had to actually look this up because I was like, when was the last nuclear plant built and how long did it take? And I believe it was Vogtle 2 or 3. Vogtle 2 and 3 took 14 and 15 years respectively to get built. And they were, I think, 6x over budget.
Yeah. Those two are in Europe, correct, or not?
Those are here in the US.
Oh, here in the US, okay.
And they escalated to several hundred million to into the billions. And now we're saying, okay, we're gonna build these SMRs, which I get it. It's a modular concept, but in my mind, they're saying 10 years. I would take the over plus 2 years minimum to get these built. And to do it at scale, I think you're closer to the 12 to 15 years. The regulatory environment and all of the rules around this, I guess what something nobody talks about is the manpower that it's going to take and the supply chain to get this done hasn't been done for years here in the US. So I would take the over of 10 years. I know there's a lot of people in the space. Bill Gates has a company that's looking at it really hard. It's doable. Again, I'm a big fan, but I think the time scale is not quite where everybody's thinking of.
You told me a little bit about your time as a nuclear submarine operator at the beginning of your career. I think our audience will find this fascinating. Can you tell us one of your stories working as an operator there, or just how it felt to work in a nuclear submarine?
The first impression most people have is it's very, very small, very tight. And It's bigger than most people think. Bigger than most people realize. It's three stories tall. I was on a fast attack submarine based off the East Coast out of Norfolk, Virginia. It's 362 feet long. Here's another stat for you. 360 feet, 8 inches at test depth. So it compresses 16 inches from front to nose to tail at 1,000 feet. That's how much it compresses.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know why I remember that stat, but yeah, that's something stuck in my head. So it's bigger than most people think, but you're also, when you first get there, up until you've been there for probably a year and a half, you're so busy all the time.
Yeah.
Between trying to get qualified to become useful and also doing all the maintenance, we're constantly running drills. So it's a chore just to get sleep. I mean, here's a story for you. I learned to sleep on a pile of plastic buoys. I would literally crash on that for a couple of hours, because when you first get on a submarine, you're doing what's called hot racking.
Okay.
You're sharing a bed with somebody, a new junior person. He's in it for 6 hours and then he's working for 12 and then you're in it for 6 hours. Yes. So but then you may find a few hours where you have some free time that I just need to sleep. And I would sleep on this bag of plastic buoys.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing. And if I can ask you, also very high level, what were your daily tasks on the nuclear submarine? What would you be busy with?
The daily stuff, you're on watch. You're sitting in a control panel. If you've ever seen a nuclear power plant, it's got literally a room full of panels, but you're sitting in front of a panel, you're watching what's going on with the nuclear reactor. You're sitting side by side with an electrical operator, so he's controlling all the electrical equipment on the submarine, as well as the electrical turbines that's pulling steam that's essentially keeping the reactor cool.
Yeah.
And then separately, you've got on the other side, you've got the turbine that spins that makes the submarine move.
Yes.
So he's the propulsion, you've got the electrical, and then you've got a reactor operator. And then on the outside of what's the control room, you've got a reactor technician running around looking at gauges that giving you information that you can't see on your panels. And then you've also got the mechanical operators. There's a lot of valves that are not, you can't just push a button yes. and make them open. They physically have to have a person there. So they're running around outside the control area. But that's about 6 hours of your day. The next 6 hours is generally doing maintenance and cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly cleaning. And then the last 6 hours of basically a 18-hour day is trying to get some sleep.
Okay, understood. Well, I will stop asking about these questions. I could keep on for a long time, but we've gone off the road here a little bit. Jumping back to data centers of this type of customer and the 24/7 matching, I can imagine that in some regions with high renewable resource, with wind speed going up, good sun shining for longer in the day, it can be easier than in other regions to offer this product. So this leads to transmission constraints sometimes because the load is located here, but the renewable resources is located somewhere else. How do you look at this problem? And can you give us a concrete example of a project where you have faced this or where you had to turn down a potential customer request because of this issue?
Well, I mean, I guess to your first point, the generation, the solar and the wind resources are not where your big load pockets are. So if you're talking to ERCOT specifically, all of your wind and most of your solar is out west.
Yeah.
So you're Odessa west to Amarillo all the way out to El Paso. And then your load pockets are Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio. So you need big transmission lines to move it from there in. So that does create an issue. when the it's too far or you're on small power lines, it does create a basis problem that someone has to take that risk. If somebody wants this, we can say, we have a project, it's located X, wherever the X is, but it's in a bad location. It's gonna cost another $10 to move it. We can develop that project, but you're gonna have to help us with the cost because we can't eat all of that. Now, the perfect solution is to put the load where the gen is. So either a behind the fence solution where you put a data center right there with wind or solar, or all the, what you're seeing lately is the new data center campuses. And you've got small gas generators on site, but then you've got wind and solar being led directly there. So it's technically all behind the fence of the data center load pocket. And then they lean on the grid to supplement it.
Okay.
That's kind of the perfect solution.
Yeah. And with all of these different projects that you've been working on and they're constantly coming up, how does AES choose to focus on a specific type of service or region in the future? How do you look at new projects and decide which ones to go for or not?
Generally speaking, I mean, we're very customer driven.
Okay.
So wherever the customers are going, you're going to see us in the same place. So wherever you see big data center pockets or data centers are following this big, it's a cable. Essentially they're going wherever there is good connectivity for the data centers onto this, not my piece of the business, but it's a fiber optic line that yes. runs all around the U.S. So they've kind of maxed out Virginia, for example, in that Dominion zone. Now they've moved to Texas. They're also moving into SPP and MISO region. So wherever you see them going, we're going the same place. CAISO, same thing.
Thank you for sharing that as well. You have lived through multiple market eras and asset types. Looking 5 to 10 years out, what's the most underappreciated risk or opportunity for a renewable heavy portfolio like AES's portfolio?
I think when I already mentioned the nukes, I think the one thing that our nukes aren't near as close as everybody thinks. And the other thing, and just to be clear, these are my opinions and my opinions only.
Yes.
Do not necessarily reflect
contrarian opinions. Usually,
do not necessarily reflect those of AES. So, that being said, all this data center growth is coming. The hyperscalers are coming. AI is driving it. We all see that. But in my mind, the hyperscalers are building these data centers so fast that the generation side cannot keep up. Gas. More than likely, if you don't steal somebody else's turbine from the line, your best case 5 years, more than likely you're 67 years out. And that's assuming you're not going to have to dig a hole for a pipe just to get gas pipe there. So I'm assuming you're putting the gas generator on top of a pipe and close to transmission lines. So assuming all that is good, I think you're 6 to 7 years out. They're building data centers in 18 to 24 months now. Somebody just scaled essentially an inflatable one in 9 months, a data center. Well, in my mind, there's an inflection point coming where you've got I don't want to put names out there, but there's a lot of AI companies spending a lot of money on debt right now on all of this AI coming, and they're betting on revenues in 2030, 2032. You can probably guess what I'm talking about based on that. But if this growth hits a plateau where you can't grow anymore because your generation can't grow as fast, your generation is going to be 5 to 6 years out before you can really start making a mark. So I think we get this inflection point where things kind of flatten out, or the acceleration slows down a lot. for a couple years before it can take off again. And I think those companies in that 2 year point where things flatten off and now they're going to have to delay their revenue captures or to try to actually make money on this instead of just capturing it with debt, they're going to be hurting. So I think that 2 year inflection point coming in roughly, call it two and a half years, there's going to be quite a few that can't make it through that point. They're expecting this just to keep going at this current rate, and it's not going to, it can't.
That's a very interesting take. We here at Motor Energy focus mostly on batteries. We're expanding into other technologies as well, such as solar. Is there any opportunity tied to batteries specifically that you see?
Of course.
In the upcoming years?
I'll give you guys a little plug. I mean, I've been following Motor Energy for a while now. You guys are very, very good at the analytics, better than most, in my
opinion.
Thank you. That being said, the one technology that can kind of help fill that blank is batteries, because you can put in a battery fairly quickly, at roughly 3 years. So that will certainly help. Nobody's really concentrated on batteries right now to fill that gap. Everybody's concentrating on gas, nukes. Nobody's really targeting batteries right now. They're going to have to consider it in the very near future. But I think that's the only thing in my mind that can fill that gap.
And in your projects, you have mentioned the big portfolio in CAISO. Are you still nowadays looking at using batteries for all of your different setups for your clients?
We are, and we are continuing to build. The majority of them are solar plus storage.
Yes.
Because even if one side or the other of the technology, so solar projects lost some value with the whole duck curve. Mm-hmm. Prices are very low, but then it created value in the battery. And the more batteries you put in, it kind of pushes the balloon the other way and solar goes back up. So we're tending to build them as projects together, solar and batteries, and we can help fill a very flat load with that. Now, in other regions like PJM, we do offer batteries. It doesn't make economic sense to, from an energy standpoint. But if you said, I see value in shifting the renewable energy credit value from a particular hour to an hour where we don't have, or we have a gap in where the wind's falling off and the solar's going down. If someone sees value in that we can't get from the typical energy markets, then there is value in the battery. We just, unless someone says I'm willing to pay for that, you can't monetize it. So the value is there. We do certainly pitch it as part of the 24/7. If someone's interested in that, we can certainly integrate it in.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Before jumping to the final section, is there any question that you can think of that I didn't ask that could be interesting for the audience?
I would be quite keen to know, right, if I'm out of college a year and I've been on a trading desk today, if you send me back in time 15, 20 years, what about being on a trading desk then is going to shock me? What's the different environment like?
I would, it's funny. I've had several conversations. I'm pretty open to talking to almost anybody. People reach out to me on LinkedIn all the time and, do you have a few minutes to talk? And a lot of times it's just a college kid.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty free with my time. I know I'm at the point in my career where I've kind of peaked and I'm just giving back, hoping other people can learn. So I have those conversations all the time. And when they ask me, what should I look at? Not necessarily a new trader yet, but they're just, I'm interested in energy space. What should I do? I see all this stuff coming. Should I learn code? And one of the things that we use quite a bit now is, obviously, we've been talking about AI. We still use AI a lot. You don't have to be a good code writer anymore. You can use AI to write your code. So what I've been telling them is, not to necessarily go after code as a skill set, but go after those people who can write the most perfect AI prompts. That is a skill set to give you a very specific answer. AI, in my opinion, does really good answer if you give it a very specific, very narrow question. If you give it the world, you can come up with some pretty wild things. But
yeah.
But that, in my opinion, is the one thing they could learn that will add value immediately. That they could step in and being able to write that very tight AI code language, whatever it is, to say, I want this specific answer.
The younger generations will appreciate this advice. Thank you for sharing it, Terry. Sure. Also, something that I'm very curious about is how trading desks nowadays have changed compared to 20 years ago. From your perspective and your experience, if you can tell us some story of the old times and now.
I guess one of the first things is when you meet me, I'm pretty unassuming. I don't have a big ego. A lot of especially the old school traders had big egos. I've been doing this for 30 years, and to make it this long, you have to set your ego aside. When I first started, it was very regular for the head of trading to yell and scream, break phones, to berate you. It was awful. And it's not my personality, not my mentality. It's a very harsh way to learn. It's the way that I learn, but it's not the way that I operate now. And the funny thing is, so our risk group, when they speak with me, they find it interesting that I don't come across as harshly as they expect, especially new senior risk people. They're expecting the head of trading to be this monster, and I'm not. And it shouldn't be. You know, we're all people, and the younger people coming in, I think they appreciate not necessarily a softer hand, but someone who's doesn't have the ego. I don't think I know everything. You know, you have just as much as offer as I do. I've just been around for a long time. I've seen a lot. You may have some new ideas that I haven't thought about, and that's great. Let's all talk and put it on the table. So I try to, again, leave the ego on the side and try to get them to do the same. And managing newer people. So a mid-level trader managing an analyst coming in, try to be a little more gentle. Bring them along. Don't have this ego. You'll learn whatever you learn by brute force. It doesn't have to be that way.
Yes.
And they may surprise you. I have some very, very bright young people that work in my group that if you give them the runway, they will come up with some great ideas as long as you're there to support and guide. And a completely different mentality than 30 years ago, right?
That's great to hear. For the audience to understand what a normal day looks as the head of trading of such a big company as the one you work at, can you describe it on a high level? Are you more of a manager, which I assume, or an individual contributor? Do you miss those days when you were an individual contributor?
Of course, you taking a step away from the day-to-day is hard, is really hard. But if you want to grow in your career, and honestly, if you want to have a bigger influence over the organization, you need to grow and do that. So my day-to-day is, I certainly look over the entire portfolio every morning. I look at what happened to P&L overnight. I look at what the position looks like, where we can trim things up, where the market's going. I've got 6 screens up. I've got all the markets up, so I'm seeing everything. I'm cognizant of big picture what's going on. I'm on the calls with weather every morning what's going on with all of our assets. And then once I get a kind of a feel for, okay, what happened overnight, get a lay of the land for where the position is, what we're looking like on a day-to-day basis. Then I, okay, what meetings do I have? What kind of management things are going on? You know, what kind of other things, the non-trading day-to-day things management-wise that have to be done. Do I miss it? Sure. It's the rush is like no other. It certainly is.
I can imagine. Is it stressful or not? Do you like it? Do you enjoy it?
It is, but if you, I don't know, it's a, sometimes you don't sleep, but you learn after a while to get used to the churning in your guts.
Yes.
And what that feels like. And, but it's also, you know, the flip side of the churning in your guts is the excitement of being there in the game every day.
Yes. I can imagine.
Whether you're winning or losing.
Yeah.
Because like I said, the one day when my biggest day ever, my guts were churning just as bad as if it had been a losing day.
What's your worst day ever? We talked about the best day ever. Oof. Your worst day.
So that was when I was working at Arizona Public Service. My group was the we supplied the loads or the supply side to our retail group, and our retail group did a monster deal. It was 2.3 terawatt hours of power in California at SP15 and MP15. And on the same day that they did that, Goldman came out and bought somebody's book, and the book was naked. And they came in buying heavily at SP15 and MP15. And it all of a sudden pushed what looked like a decent position to cover to, oh my God, this is getting pushed in my face really hard. And they just kept in buying. Every time I would go to buy, I lift that offer. I'm ahead of you all the time. It's like, oh my God. So I had to buy at Palo and at Mid C and anywhere else I could.
Yes.
To try to stay away from California, just to try to fill energy and, but wearing a lot of basis. And that day, them filling their book essentially pushed me down about $7.5 million.
Wow. And you survived the day?
But and it took me about 6 weeks. But after they quit buying,
yes,
the market kind of came back to where it should have. And all of those spreads started coming back in. And I was able to sell out of Palo by SP, sell out of Mid C by MP. And so I came back and I actually made money on the position, but I had to take this very short-term mark-to-market loss that hurt.
I'm enjoying a lot of your stories. Thank you for sharing them, Terry. Jumping to the final section, unless you have another question in your mind. is there anything you would like to plug or promote to our audience?
All of our big things you'll see in press releases. So I'm aware of things coming, but I really can't talk about the big things. I would say in the next 30 days, you should be expecting something big from AES. Anywhere where you see a large data center going in or a data center complex, expect us to be in that conversation. If you don't see us right away, we're there. We're there behind the scenes, either with helping something happen or as part of the deal. So even when you don't hear about it, if you see a big data center, we're there.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. And the final question that we ask to everyone, you are a contrarian person by nature, try to make your bets on that gut feeling that you have. You have given some contrarian views already, but is there any other contrarian view that you would like to share now that most of the people wouldn't share with you?
Well, I already talked about the nukes. I think, like I said, the nukes, everybody's saying 10 years, I would definitely take the over on that.
Yeah.
The inflection point is certainly one that I'm not sure many people share, so maybe that's contrarian, that I haven't heard that before. And I don't see that happening. The one thing that I guess the ISO is finally opening their eyes to the large loads coming in and kind of restricting the growth.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, the consumers are wearing the brunt of that if they don't. So that kind of, that surprised me a little bit. But I guess my contrarian, the big one would just be that inflection point where I think it's not going to be as fast as everybody talks about because of the generation growth can't happen at the same rate.
Okay. That's a great contrarian view. Thank you for sharing it, Terry. It was a pleasure to have you today with us.
This was fun. This was a lot of fun.
And thank you for coming.
Yeah, you're welcome.